Well, last week there were reports, unconfirmed by the government, that the federal cabinet has approved an environmental plan that would include strict new emissions targets for automakers. Absent from the hints the government has been making on what to expect in its so-called Green Plan 2, however, is any clarity on the K word, Kyoto, the international accord on greenhouse gas reductions that the Liberals, of course, pledged Canada to uphold. And while politicians, pundits, and lobbyists bicker over what Canada can and should do to reduce greenhouse gases, we're going to look at the problem from a completely different angle this morning. Geoengineering is the science of rearranging the Earth's environment on a dramatic scale to make it more habitable. It could mean building giant sunshades in space to cool the Earth or covering a steaming desert with plastic sheeting. In a moment, we'll trot out more of these ideas. But first, when it comes to global warming, my first guest says we should concern ourselves less with reversing the trend and more with adapting to its inevitability. Frances Cairncross is an economist and the president of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, and she's in Oxford, England. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
What is the rationale behind the idea of adaptation?
Well, first of all, can I say that I'm not suggesting we should do less about trying to stop global warming, because I think there is a real big problem there. I am saying, however, that we also need to think about adapting, because whatever we do, global warming is still going to happen. There is still going to be some climate change. Really, if we threw everything we could at trying to stop global warming, we still almost certainly would have some change in the climate, and we need to start to think how we're going to deal with that.
So we need to look at geoengineering first as an immediate reaction and to buy ourselves time to do the other work.
I'm not saying we should look first at geoengineering. There are other ways in which we should adapt, which are more sensible and more modest. The first sort of things that we've got to do are to try to think about the way in which developing countries in particular are going to survive with a warmer climate, because people who live in developing countries are much more vulnerable because they're dependent on agriculture, because many of them live near coasts at sea level, because they're susceptible to the effects of drought. They're much more susceptible to the effects of climate change than we are in richer, cooler countries. So the first thing we ought to be doing is thinking about developing countries and looking at our aid programs. We also ought to be thinking about what happens in our own countries and how people can be encouraged to adapt there. Some adaptation will take place through the private sector. People will install cooling systems, for example. But some needs the government's involvement, and thinking about when people are allowed to build on land that's currently at or below sea level is one very important part of all of this. Only once we've done all that should we throw a lot of money at geoengineering, which is much more science fiction stuff and where we may need something to happen, but we should first of all concentrate on what we can do relatively easily and cheaply.
And where does this leave this idea leave the science and political capital that's already so heavily invested in reducing greenhouse gases as the means to combat global warming?
Well, a lot of environmental activists are very worried about any discussion of adaptation. And they are worried because they think it will steer attention away from trying to prevent climate change in the first place. There is some truth in what they say. I think that particularly with some of these grander solutions, geoengineering solutions, I think if we become very involved in spending money on those, it may deflect money away from technologies that will use the energy we are using in more efficient ways. But I think that we do need, as a planet, to think about adaptation, because that's going to happen.
And what kind of political response, then, has the idea of adaptation received?
So far, politicians have kept pretty quiet about it. I think that may change as it becomes clearer that something is really happening in this area. I am going to read with great interest the report that the British government's most senior economist, Sir Nicholas Stern, is putting the finishing touches to right this moment. It will come out in a few weeks' time, and I think it will have quite a lot to say about what we ought to do to help developing countries.
And give us an idea of the kind of criticism the idea has attracted.
The main criticism has been that if we are too bogged down in worrying about adaptation, we won't do anything about preventing climate change. That's really the crux of the debate. I think there is also, though, another issue which hasn't come into public discussion yet, but I think it will do, and that is this. A lot of the work on geoengineering is going to take place in North America, particularly in the United States. America, as we all know, is currently the largest single contributor of global warming emissions. America is a great place for looking at technical fixes, and technical fixes that cut the use of fossil fuels are great. But there is a real danger that America may unilaterally come up with some technical geoengineering fix that it will then deploy, even if there is anxiety or hostility in other parts of the world as to what the side effects of this fix might be. That won't be an issue for another 5 or 10 years, but it will undoubtedly appear on the radar in the next decade.
Interesting. Now, you are an economist. From an economics perspective, how does adaptation work with market forces?
Adaptation works very well with market forces because it's something that happens on the whole locally or nationally. Many of the biggest difficulties with introducing measures that will really curb climate change are that the curbing measures have to be taken internationally. We all have to act together, or at least the main global warmers have to act together. And that requires international agreement, which is very difficult to achieve. And it's all the more difficult to achieve because some of the countries that are the greatest villains in all of this won't suffer as much as some of the countries that are much smaller emitters of global warming gases. So there's a cost-benefit problem here to individual nations. That's not the case with adaptation, where countries have a very clear interest in taking measures to adapt internally. America has a very clear interest in doing something sensible in rebuilding New Orleans. Canada has a very clear interest in thinking about what to do with its coastal areas. So there is a much clearer national interest in doing something about adaptation, which means it will be much easier to get it to happen.
And so how do these ideas around adaptation get turned into real policy?
I think we need a discussion in the press. We need a discussion among politicians. We need environmental activists to stop getting up and shouting every time the word adaptation is mentioned. And if we do all of that, then I think things will start to happen within the next few years.
And you're saying, as well as the technology that we have to look at, we also should just be looking at planning again, where we put cities and coastal areas. And is there a possibility we would have to change the way we live on coasts?
Some coastal habitations will only remain habitable with a great deal of investment. If you look at the Netherlands, quite large chunks of land in the Netherlands are below sea level. They are kept in use and kept habitable by a great deal of spending on building and maintaining dikes, sea walls. That's not going to be a possibility for countries like the Maldive Islands or indeed countries like Bangladesh, which are going to have a really big problem unless those countries have help from the international community. And that's an area where adaptation will require international agreement, and we need to start thinking internationally how much money, literally how much money, we're prepared as a world community to spend to try to keep Bangladesh at its present geographical size.
Lots to think about there. Frances Cairncross, thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Frances Cairncross is an economist and the president of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, and she spoke to us from Oxford, England. Well, the idea behind geoengineering, manipulating the environment to offset problems such as global warming, is slowly starting to gain legitimacy in scientific circles. Alvia Gaskell is the president of the consulting firm Environmental Reference Materials, which tracks geoengineering trends and creates new technology, and he joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, as we talk about geoengineering as being an important part of this puzzle, what is the science community starting? Why is it now starting to embrace geoengineering?
Well, I think it's largely because of a realization and a recognition that the measures that were going to be taken to reduce emissions are simply not going to happen in time, and the dire outcome of not getting the emissions reduced is probably going to occur a lot sooner. I think the recent report from NASA regarding the melting of the permanent sea ice in the Arctic is certainly setting off alarm bells in every scientist's office on this planet right now. And so therefore, scientists who had previously been a dead set opposed to this are now in the camp of, well, we at least have to take a look at this because we're not going to be able to do it with treaties or with emission reduction technologies in time.
And what has been the obstacle for scientists in accepting this, though?
Oh, there's a whole list of things. Your previous guest, I just wanted to bring one thing up that she mentioned about unilateral deployment by the United States. I don't think that's really very likely. Most of these technologies, for various reasons, require international cooperation because they require doing things all over the planet. And so I think it's highly unlikely that the United States would go it alone, or any country would go it alone, although one cannot rule that out if things get very tough 25 years from now or 15 years from now, and countries have to make decisions in their own best interests, and they'll forget about any kind of moratoriums on developing technologies or deploying them. So it really is sort of a loaded gun almost as to what might actually happen.
Now, there are scientists who dismiss geoengineering, saying that the efforts should be made to reduce emissions through cleaner energy, not tinkering with the world's atmosphere. You think that's a dangerous attitude. Why?
Well, I think because of the time involved. If we had 100 years or 200 years to make the emissions reductions, I think most people would agree that that's probably enough time to do it. But clearly, you're looking at an installed base of power plants and factories and the home heating systems that will take decades to replace once technologies are available that can replace them. Fuel cells probably are not going to be available for cars for 20, 30, perhaps 40 years. And so if you look at the numbers and the way the warming is taking place, a lot of the damage is going to be well underway before one can envision significant amounts of new technologies being in place. So the people who would like to dismiss this as a diversion or something to give CEOs and politicians an opportunity to continue with business as usual, I think they have a point to be made there. But I think we're beyond that right now. I think we're almost in a desperate situation. So we have to start looking at things we can do right now and not things that we will do 20 or 30 years from now.
And if geoengineering is about changing the environment and the atmosphere through large-scale scientific experiments and projects, how can we be sure that they won't do more harm than good down the road?
Well, the way to do that, of course, is with any kind of scientific experiment, is you do it on a small scale first, and then you proceed to larger trials until finally the full scale is attained. And in the case of many of these technologies that some we'll talk about and that the other guests will talk about, they would have to be done on a small scale to begin with, and if things were noticed that were causing problems that were considered to be unacceptable, then the work could be stopped. And so this is not like a science fiction movie where they push a button and the disastrous consequence occurs and it's too late and you can't take it back. So I think there would be ample opportunity to make those kinds of judgments along the way.
And you're right, we have a few people waiting in the wings to tell us about some inventions, but tell us about some of the geoengineering technology your company's working on.
Well, what we looked at is primarily technologies to reflect sunlight and technologies that would be practical. That was one of the major points. Obviously, there's been, you'll hear about the space-borne reflectors, and there's also ideas about removing carbon dioxide through fertilization of the ocean with micronutrients. But we looked at technologies that we thought could actually be applied using what we have available today. Basically, 20th century technology is what we would, that's essentially what we have to work with right now. And we decided to look at what would happen if you covered the surface of the Earth, a part of it, with a white reflective cover, because obviously the source of the energy of the greenhouse effect is sunlight. And if you can reflect sunlight off the surface before it can be absorbed by the surface and then re-emitted as infrared radiation, then you've stopped part of the process that is heating the atmosphere and ultimately the whole planet.
So the same way the ice cap reflects the sun.
Exactly. In fact,
you put it?
Well, interestingly enough, the Bush administration in September 2001 was looking at alternatives to Kyoto, and one of the things they looked at was building plastic islands in the Arctic to replace the glaciers and to replace the ice, the melting sea ice. And they decided against that because it was too expensive, and for various other reasons, they went on to other options to pursue. But we settled on the deserts because they seem to have a lot of characteristics that would be acceptable. The large quantity of land, which is not occupied by humans, very little biological activity. Approximately 75% of it is gravel plains and dry lake beds, so it's almost an environment where it's not like a parking lot, but you could certainly foresee covering it with some sort of a reflective material and it staying in place.
These would be deserts where? This would be the Sahara, this be U.S. deserts?
Well, actually, the United States, again, the United States could not do that one unilaterally because we have very little land that actually is suitable for that purpose. The primary areas of interest would be the Sahara, the Arabian Desert, and the Australian Desert. So collectively, the world has about 7.5 million square miles of what is considered a desert and arid land, and about 4.5 million of that would be in that category of the lake beds and the suitable for coverage with the coverage with plastic. And but the deserts also would be a good choice because the sky is fairly clear most of the time, so you're going to get largely the maximum amount of sunlight reflected back into space. And also the lack of humidity means you're going to get not much absorption of solar radiation on the way down. Most people don't realize it, but 20% of the sunlight is absorbed by water vapor when it comes into the atmosphere. So there's actually absorption on the way in and also on the way out. So the deserts were, you know, a choice that would be, I think, you know, if you had to choose someplace to do it, this would probably be the best choice. Although I've now started thinking about doing something with some of the land bordering the Arctic Sea, again, because of this impending disaster with the melting of the sea ice.
You'd have to get permission for that, too, though, right?
Well, you'd have to get permission.
You're trying to get in on Canadian territory there.
That's right. But, you know, there's Russia. There's also some U.S. land again. But, I think all these options have to be explored in terms of what they might produce. One of the objections to the coverage of the desert land is that it would provide an uneven cooling of the Earth's surface, whereas the, putting mirrors in outer space, some computer modeling has shown that ends up reflecting sunlight equally over the whole planet, so you don't end up with hot and cold spots. Well, I think you would probably end up with some regional climate differences brought on by covering desert lands in this sort of, you know, way where the land is going to be covered in basically, you know, a limited area of the planet. However, there's some advantages to that, however, that people may not be aware of. That you may be familiar with the dust flow that comes off the Sahara that goes across the Atlantic Ocean. That provides a lot of the nutrients for the Amazon, but it also provides mold spores that make a lot of the children sick in the Caribbean, and that's been increasing over the last 20 years. So covering up some of that dust that's not really necessary would have some health benefits. It also would reduce the levels of iron to reduce the toxic red tide blooms. And another area...
Alvia Gasco, we're going to have to leave that one there because I do have someone else waiting in the wings to be a little more detailed about the ocean idea. So I'll leave it there, but thank you for your thoughts.
I appreciate it very much.
Bye-bye. That's Alvia Gasco, who's the president of the consulting firm Environmental Reference Materials. He spoke to us from Durham, North Carolina. Now, Stephen Salter is waiting in the wings, is a geoengineer at the University of Edinburgh who has come up with a novel take on how to cool down the planet. He's researched and developed something called the Albedo Spray Vessel, an ocean-going vessel designed to reduce global warming. And he's with us now. Hello.
Hello.
Am I saying it right? Albedo Spray Vessel?
That's right. Albedo just means whiteness.
And how does this work? I understand you've got something that would look like a giant egg beater.
Not really, but anyway. It's all based on a bit of physics called the Twomey effect. If you put Twomey, that's T-W-O-M-E-Y, plus albedo into Google, you'll get papers written since the 70s, which are explaining what makes clouds be very white or mediumly white or darkish grey. And Twomey found out that it's the size distribution of the drops in the clouds. If you have, for a given amount of water, if you have a lot of small drops, it's whiter than if you have a smaller number of big drops. And a chap called John Latham realized that if you could add extra cloud condensation nuclei to the clouds that are over the sea, you would shift the size distribution of the drops in them and you could make them be a little bit whiter. And you only need to change the albedo by about 1.5% to have twice the carbon dioxide that we got now with no temperature change at all. Only 1.5%. It's a tiny, tiny difference. And so what we need to do is to think of a way to get lots of extra cloud condensation nuclei, maybe 50% more, in the places where we've got the right kind of clouds. They're called marine stratocumulus clouds. And it's going to take some energy to do this. And we think the best way to get the energy is to have sailing vessels, which can be moved anywhere where the right kind of clouds are, and they need to move with the seasons. And they would be sailing through the water, across the wind, on a beam reach. And they'd be dragging propellers through the water, which will give you the energy that you need to make the spray. And Latham did the calculations, which other people have been checking, and they seem to be quite right, that if you could spray 10 to the 18 drops a second, that's 1 and 18 noughts, it's quite a lot of drops, 10 to the 18 a second, you'd make you'd correct about a year's increase in the heating effects of a year's increase of carbon dioxide. Now, that sounds like a very large number of drops, but if you, the nice size for them is a micron or less, and that's only about half a cubic meter of water a second. So it's really a manageable amount of water a second to spray. And this could be done with perhaps 50 or 100 boats that would be cruising around, dragging their propellers and making the spray. We now know where they should be, where the best places are, and the best places change through the year. And what we'd really like to concentrate on is cooling the water, which is on its way to the Arctic, because this gives you a way to restore the ice cover, and it also might reduce the releases of methane from the permafrost in Siberia and northern Canada, which is coming off much faster than anybody thought.
What kind of feedback have you had on this idea?
Well, basically all the atmospheric physicists say that the physics is quite sound, if only the engineering can be done. And I haven't had any objections to the ideas for the engineering yet, but I also haven't been able to get any money to do the development for it. We think we'd answer all the difficult engineering questions for about £2 million, and we'd be ready to get the vessels going to sea for about £20 or £30 million. And from then on, we'd need to spend a few hundred million pounds making extra vessels each year. So it's really quite a cheap thing to do. And the reason it's so cheap is that the energy that you put in, you take out of the wind, is geared up by a factor of about a million in the amount of energy that's reflected out. It's an incredible energy gain. About 500 kilowatts on each vessel is reflecting enormously much more of the solar energy back out to space. The other thing that we like a lot about it is that it's continuously controllable. It's the drops that you spray only last about a week. So if it turns out to be doing it in the wrong place or doing it the wrong time or doing it too much, you can switch off instantly. You just send a message out. They've all got satellite navigation and mobile phones, and you can make them go somewhere else or switch off or whatever you want to do. So it's completely reversible and it's continuously controllable.
Stephen Salter, thanks for talking to us about your idea. Thank you. Stephen Salter is a geoengineer at the University of Edinburgh. Now we're going to go from corralling clouds to aiming mirrors to tell us about another innovative way to cool down a heated planet. I'm joined by Dr. Roger Angel. He's an astronomer and the director of the Center for Astronomical Adaptive Optics at the University of Arizona, and he is in Tucson. Hello.
Hi.
Well, tell us about your technology and how it would deflect the sun rays, the sun's rays from the Earth, away from the Earth.
Okay. It's actually an idea that's been around for 20 years or more, because people already recognize that there might be a problem coming there. It's actually not mirrors in space. It's lenses. It turns out it's technically better to deflect the light a little bit to one side rather than reflect it back. I think the calculations from Ken Kildare and others have shown that you need to reduce the solar flux by about a couple of percent in order to reverse the effect of doubling of carbon dioxide. And so that means if you want to do this from space, you need something that's about 2% the size of the Earth, which is pretty big. But I've, in the last year or so, I've been saying, well, if we actually wanted to do this, you know, what would be the most practical method and how much might it cost, and what kind of investment ought we be making now, right, to see what to look at the technology and look at, you know, the difficult parts of it.
Maybe you can explain just a little more clearly. You're talking about putting lenses, and I read something that they're wafer thin. They're about as light as a butterfly, I read. Is that what you're talking about, putting a large number of them into where, space?
In space. The advantage of putting things in space is that you don't further change the atmosphere at all. So I think predicting what's going to happen may be a little easier, because the only thing you do is sort of dim the sun by just a little bit. There's one spot in space where you want to put these things, and there's a point about a million miles from Earth on the line to the sun, where if you put a satellite there, it pretty much stays in line with the sun. unfortunately, it's not completely stable there, and so you can't just put up a cloud of dust and expect it to stay in that line. It'll drift off. So we have to put up a cloud of satellites that have a little bit of control to them that will hold them on the line.
Literally have to herd them into place.
That's right. So each one has a little brain, and it looks at where it is, and it actually steers itself with sunlight to hold on the line.
And how much of an impact would putting up these lenses have on global warming?
The amount of energy that you need to get them there is about a thousandth of the energy that they deflect. So it's an efficient way to go. Or I should say, it's a thousandth of the energy that you've mitigated. So if you understand what I'm saying.
And would you have to replace it on a regular basis? Would they?
Yeah, the lifetime of things in space, currently satellites last about 20 years. And I think with a little engineering, we might get these to last 50 years. So compared to things like putting sulfur in the atmosphere or clouds or whatever, it's a more expensive startup cost. But once you've done it, it's likely to last for a long time. It has the same thing. If you don't like it, it's very easy to move these things off. The difficulty is holding them on the line, not moving them off if you want them to go away.
And how quickly could you do this?
This is a sort of intermediate term solution, I think. My estimate is that if you started now to sort out the ideas and do the critical engineering tests, it would take at least a decade to work out the technology. And then if you launched this stuff going as fast as you could, it would take another decade. And that's the very optimistic view. So more realistic, it might be 25 years before you could get any benefit from this. But then once you've done that, then you would have that benefit for another 50 years.
Okay, well, very interesting stuff. Dr. Roger Angel, you get the last word today. We are out of time. Thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you.
Dr. Roger Angel is the director for the Center for Astronomical Adaptive Optics at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And that is it for The Current Today. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Thank you for listening.